Okay, la. They can start this morning's talk. So far in the morning talks, I've talked in more detail about the meditation. And to start off with the sweeping of the body, get to know the body, mindful of the body, and just be able to learn how to relax it, how to make it feel easy, peaceful. And that helps obviously in many, many areas in life, including learning how to go to sleep in the evenings. But then you went over to the peaceometer, and I really encourage you to develop that awareness of the peaceometer. So you know how peaceful you are, how agitated you are, and you also know what causes that agitation and just how unnecessary it is. Now we plan, we worry, we're anxious about things which mostly don't happen. With anxiety, I recall the story of a lady who I first met about 35 years ago, at least 30 years ago, when I gave my first talk at a Cancer Support Association. They've changed their names since that time. Now it's Solaris Cancer Care, but it's still the same organization, the same people. And this woman, she had had breast cancer, was been in remission, and managed to get through it. But then she had a psychological problem afterwards. It was so unpleasant for her that the thought that it would come back again was terrifying her. And that anxiety was causing her so much distress that even with the free counseling, great psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, no one could dislodge that fear from her. Until this weird fellow came along with a bald head and a brown robe with no qualifications in psychology. When he asked the question, which he'd asked so many people, he said, what would happen if the cancer came back? And of course, you know, that without missing a beat, I said, well, how about considering what would happen if it didn't come back? And she understood straight away. And she was actually ready to understand that. She had been thinking all the time about the anxiety. What would happen if something went wrong? It's looking at the future with a fault-finding negative mind. And I suggested, what would happen if it didn't? And strangely enough, when you're in a negative mood, you never think like that. You never even contemplate the possibility. Actually, the odds are that it won't come back. And so that was the first time she could actually focus on, well, what would happen if it didn't come back? And it was, about 25 years later, when they were having a ceremony for their centre over in Cottesloe, that she came up to me and said, you know, just 25 years ago you gave me that teaching and the cancer has never come back. But I come back every year to see you. She comes back, but not the cancer. But there's a wonderful little story there, just about how we waste so much energy. And of course, you can understand that if she kept on thinking, oh, what's going to happen if it comes back? What's going to happen if it comes back? That fear, that anxiety, that tension would increase the odds of the cancer coming back. And that's one of the reasons why we can see straight away the peaceometer. Just about every sort of person in the health professions know that if you can develop a peaceful mind, that's always really, really positive for your health. Not just a peaceful body, but a mind which has got a very, very low reading on the peaceometer. So when you can develop that, you know, you get sort of really healthy, but also you get a great deal of wisdom and understanding. What makes me anxious? And so many things which made me anxious were counterproductive. You start off with a simile of with a story when I first got my very first bicycle when I was 10 or 11 years of age. And of course, only two wheels on that bicycle, so I was always afraid of falling off. And because of the fear of falling off, I would grab those handlebars until my knuckles were white, grip them, and I'd be so stiff when you went round a corner that you kept falling off. And until you had the confidence just, you know, to allow the body to go with the bike, to actually to move with the bike as you went round corners. And of course then you stopped falling off. And the fear of falling off was what was making me fall off. And the other simile which someone told me a long time ago, which, now these similes answer some questions which you always wonder about. If you've got a mind which wanders about life, I don't mean a wandering mind, I mean an exploration inclined mind. You always would notice that the birds who went to sleep up in the trees, roosting on the branches and on the twigs of those trees, that sometimes at night there was a storm and a tree would sway backwards and forwards. And I'd always think, that's just a very, very dangerous place to go to sleep, on a tree which is swaying backwards and forwards. But in the morning, I never, ever once saw a bird which fell off in the middle of the night. When I was in bed, sometimes you'd fall out of bed. But that's one of the reasons why monks sleep on the floor. You can keep rolling and you never fall off. But how come the birds never fall off? If that was me, sort of sitting on top of a tree somewhere, and it was windy, I'd be grabbing on with all my might in case I fell off. I'd be clinging on for dear life. I'd be just so stressed all night, hour after. I could never go to sleep clinging on like that. But then you found, it was an ornithologist told me, it's the nature of the bird's claws, its feet, that when it relaxes, it closes up. The more relaxed, the more it closes. The more it lets go, the more it's unlikely to fall off. And I thought, what a wonderful simile that is for meditation. The more you try to hold on to, you know, the breath, the more likely it is it's going to fall off. The more you try to be still, the more agitated you'll be. So if you can imagine you're a bird on a tree going to sleep at night, just let go, let go, let go. And the claws close onto that wood of the branch or the twig, and you're so stable. If you're, say, watching your breathing, if you try and hold it, you'll find you'll fall off. If you just let go, and the mind quite naturally will hold on to the breathing. It's counterintuitive, which is one of the reasons why people do need a teacher to keep brainwashing them day after day after day to teach them how to be like a bird so you never fall off on your meditation. So understanding this practice of letting go, striving doesn't reach the goal, letting go reaches the goal which striving sort of thought it would give you. It gives you peace and stability when you let go. So anyway, when we are watching the breathing, I want you to move on to the breathing, because often this just comes by itself. However, many of you have done breath meditation before, so it's almost like a habit. You just go to the breath anyway. You choose to watch the breath. You'll invite the breath in. But that word, if you are going to choose to watch the breathing, don't force it to come in. Don't grab it by the arm and pull it in. Come on, breath, sit down and stay in here with me. I like the word inviting it in. In other words, you give it free permission to refuse if it doesn't want to come in and stay with you. But you invite it in a lot of time if you're kind and if you're ready. It's quite easy to watch the breath. But what do we mean by watching the breath? So I always like in the morning to give some exercises, not just to talk, but to let you actually experience things. So you don't need to change your posture. Just close your eyes and just watch three breaths, in, out, in, out, in, out. And at the end of the third breath, open your eyes, okay? Just three breaths, that's all. Did anyone have any trouble with that? Could you watch your breaths? Okay, now close your eyes again and watch 3,000 breaths. That's the trouble. What's the difference? The difference is 3,000. Your mind goes off into the future. I can't do that. Three breaths. Easy. But number two is, how did you watch the breath? Where did you watch it? Tip of the nose, belly, under your left ear. Where did you watch it? You didn't actually choose. A lot of times when people first come and learn meditation, I give them that exercise to show, yes, it's confidence building. They can watch the breath, three breaths. And number two, how did they watch the breath? How were they aware of the breath? When I did not give them instructions on where to watch, they observed the breath naturally. And they weren't forced to watch it at a place which wasn't natural, where the breath didn't exist. They just knew the breath was going in and going out. And of course, my history of learning breath meditation, I was first told to watch the breath at the tip of my nose. And if you try to watch the breath at the tip of the nose, when you've got a cold and you're sneezy, or you've got hay fever and your nose is all blocked up, you can't watch the breath at the tip of the nose. There's nothing going on there. You're stuffed up. And so then when I heard that you could watch the breath at your belly, the rise and fall of your abdomen, I thought that was a good way I could do it. The only trouble was that when you become a monk, or when you're on 8 precepts, in the evening, maybe about 9 o'clock, when you start watching your breath at the abdomen, the awareness just moves a few inches to your empty stomach, and you feel hungry. Especially when you're a young man, you're really hungry. And so, you think, oh, that didn't work either. And for me, it was one of those, how on earth do I watch the breath? I've either got hay fever or I'm hungry. There's only certain times of the year, certain times of the day, I will be able to do breath meditation. That's not really helpful. Until, you know, you started to stand back and have a look. What on earth is going on? And of course, you know, you looked at the suttas in the Pali. What did the Buddha say? He just said, watch the breath. Never once did he said, watch the nose. It was never called nose meditation. Nor was it called belly meditation. It was called breath meditation. And so something clicked. He said, well, it doesn't matter if I'm hungry. It doesn't matter if I'm sick. It doesn't matter if I've got hay fever or got a cold or a flu. I'm always breathing. And I can always know that I'm breathing in. I can always know that I'm breathing out. So that's what I need to watch. Just the breath. Not the place where it was going in. Not the place where it was going out. I just knew I was breathing. So I just developed that awareness of the breath. Where it was located, it didn't matter. And that was fortunate for me. Sometimes when you have any difficulties in life, you can always turn them to your advantage. And to me, that was learning how what breath meditation really meant. And also, it got past some of the problems people have with breath meditation. And one of those problems, it was the first time that I went to Malaysia to teach meditation. When I went to Malaysia to teach meditation, I could not understand why so many people were complaining about samadhi headache, meditation headache. And I thought, I've never heard that before. All the years I was in Thailand, you meditated to get rid of headaches, not to make them. What on earth was happening there? Meditation headache? When I meditate, you relax. You feel so wonderful afterwards. Alert, peaceful, happy, with no, sometimes, you know, not a pain anywhere in the body. You may start off with some pains, but after a while they're just gone. So, what was going on there? And then talking to a number of meditators, they say they were taught, they were trained to watch the breath at the tip of the nose. They had to watch the breath at the tip of the nose. There was no alternative. And again, using your science background, what happens if you watch the breath at the tip of the nose for too long? Now, I take my glasses off for this demonstration, which I do every retreat. And I'm now going to do the breath meditation on the tip of the nose. But I'm going to keep my eyelids open this time. So you can see what happens to my eyeballs when my mind starts to watch the breath at the tip of the nose. But you don't realize it, that what your mind watches, your eyeballs follow. So the people doing the breath meditation on the tip of the nose are going cross-eyed for about 10 or 15 minutes, and if I carry on this any longer, I'll get a headache across here. It's a simple solution why that happens. Because, you know, what you actually, your mind watches, your eyeballs tend to follow. But you don't realize it's underneath, not for everybody, but for most people. And that's where the headache comes from. Just straining, pushing your attention there for too long, you get tense. So, instead of doing that, we just know the breath. It's going in, it's going out. Easy. Now, just so that you can be innovative, you all know Singapore is supposed to be a center of innovation. So, Jhana Grove, here's a center of meditation innovation. I am now going to teach you, no one else has actually taken this up, backwards breath meditation. It's innovative. Have you ever heard that before? It's not in the sutras, I must admit. So, I'm now going to invite you to do backwards breath meditation. So close your eyes. Now I want you again to watch three breaths, but now I want you to begin with the out breath. Out first, then in. Out, then in. Out, then in. And at the end of the third in breath, open your eyes. Okay, you can start on the next out breath. And you will probably have discovered it's actually different. So breathing in, we always tend to breathe in first. In, out, in, out, in, out. No, do out, in, out, in, out, in. It actually is a different perception. It's more interesting. It's not the same old boring. In, out, in, out. So you do out, in, out, in. Be a bit rebellious, have you? So now we do, you can do the next innovation. It's called the three in breaths to one out breath. Don't do that, I'm only playing around. But the out in actually does work, because sometimes you get into habits. You know, you've been doing breath meditation for a long time. Okay, watch the breath, breathing in, out. And you've done it such a long time, just the mind thinking, oh, this is easy, I don't need to pay attention to this. And so you just blank out. Like anything else, you know, you sometimes you're brushing your teeth in the morning and you do it the same way every day, and after a while you don't need any attention anymore. You don't know what you're doing. You brush your teeth, yeah, but you don't know exactly what you're doing. So that's another one, to get more mindfulness, make life more interesting. When you brush your teeth, where do you start? Is it in the middle, top, or is the bottom left? Where do you start? Next time, start somewhere else. Be rebellious, innovative. If you start up here, if it's the top left, start in the bottom middle. And go that way. And start here and go down. As I often say, live on the wild side. Do things differently. It takes mindfulness to do that. To do something which is breaks habits. When you're a creature of habit, it's like you die. You're like a robot. You just do it the same way every time. So that's one of the reasons why when you're watching the breath, mess around. Just three in-breath, one out-breath. Or something. At the beginning, okay, it's doing something, I agree, but it just makes it interesting. Well, that's also why we have these wonderful little words, these mantras. You can stay with the breath, breathing in peace, breathing out, let go. So if you do those little mantras with the breath, imagine it. Don't just say breathing in, peace, breathing out, let go, breathing in, peace, breathing out, let go. That's boring. Imagine what peace is. Imagine peace. How you would visualize it, how you'd experience it physically. When you see peace. Sometimes this retreat center, this is a beautiful place for retreat centers because there's no flight path. Maybe our private aircraft go past. And there's a little bit of traffic, but not much. And the animals in Australia, not like in Asia, just at night time, all the crickets chirping away. It can be really noisy in the forests of Asia. But here, the only noise is the hop, hop of the kangaroos. And the kangaroos are such peaceful little animals. They don't make much noises. So that's why this forest is just so calm. Just a little bird, that's all. So you can actually listen to the peace. You can actually feel it. You can get to know it. It really sort of, when you breathe in peace, you breathe in something which is not a word, but which is like a living entity. Which comes into your body and just brings all this incredible, healthy, spiritual nourishing, psychologically cleansing energy of peace. You can feel it go right into your body. Peace through every pore. And then, we do have history, we have karma, we have sicknesses, we have stuff, tensions. And as you breathe out, you can imagine breathing out all of that tension. All of that heaviness and the tightness of the past and all of that anxiety for the future, feel it all leaving you with every out-breath. You feel your body being cleansed of all this stuff as it goes out. And it brings some more peace with every breath. I need this. And then let it go out with all of the tiredness, all of the bad energies. Let it go out. So someone else can breathe those bad energies. No, that's not how it works. So when you use your mind like that, the mind has a lot of power. And then you really feel it. It makes the breath really interesting. And you do that for a while. And it is doing. And then you can actually feel the breath. And it becomes natural. You feel the breath coming in, breath going out. Now, I did mention, somebody mentioned last night about the calming the sankharas. The first one is the kaya sankhara, which is the breath, and then the chitta sankhara, which is actually, this is actually what creates the feeling of pleasure with the breath. so peaceful, so nice. Remember, it's Tuesday today. Many of you will be at the office by now, suffering. So always appreciate, oh, it's a great, no boss. We have got a boss, but you know, it's not a real boss, Ajahn Brahm. It's wonderful, you're just so free today. And if you feel tired, you can just go into your room and take a nap. Can you do that at work? No way. And then, you know, you just have a nice lunch, have a nap after lunch, you want to have a nice walk if you want to, no one's checking up. You don't have anything to produce. You don't have to report, write emails, or make deals, or get profits, or get your sales targets up. Isn't this bliss? Nothing to do for the whole week. Yay! So don't you get your sales targets, your own sales targets. How many hours am I meditating? And you keep a record of that. I've got to make some more meditation by the end of the day, otherwise I haven't reached my targets. That kills you. So don't do that. This is another thing. See how little you can do today. Your personal, not personal best, but personal worst. PW. See how you can perfect the art of doing nothing. Are you any good at doing nothing? Or any time you do nothing, do you feel guilty? I should be doing something. Everyone else is doing nothing. That's a problem. If more people did nothing, it would be kindness. It would be encouraging other people to relax as well. So out of compassion for others, stop meditating. I'll get in big trouble for the things I say, but you get the idea of what I'm talking about. So in order to just well, you're watching the breath, that's all. You're not trying to watch the breath, you're not focusing. You're not concentrating, for goodness sake, concentration. If you do concentration, what is this place called? Concentration camp. Do you want to go to a concentration camp? Well, this is not a concentration camp. This is a stillness, a peace camp. So when you do that, then your attitude towards the breath changes. You're just hanging out with the breath, breathing in, breathing out. And because you're not forcing, it becomes happiness and joyful. There's so much happiness and joy and beauty in this place. You just, you know, it's for there for the watching. It's beautiful. Not quite the full moon yet, but the full moon was out last night. Almost full. And sometimes you get up in the early morning. Oh, and sometimes you can sit on the stupa. It's a bit chilly, but it's beautiful air. It's clean air. No dust, no pollution. And then you can just watch the trees. In the early morning, in the early morning dawn light. That's one of the best lights of the day, just passed on. It's clean, it's free of sound. You have these beautiful views over there to the west is the Indian Ocean. So the whole area is just very conducive to peace and tranquility. And then when you do that early in the morning, you feel what the peace is, and you're not rushing to get to the hall to meditate. You're actually understanding what this hall is here for. It's for peace. And so as you develop that sense of peace with the breath, you can just watch the breath and it becomes beautiful. Now what I started off by calling the beautiful breath, but sometimes people say, what do you mean the beautiful breath? So usually these days I call it the delightful breath. So, I was just a week or two ago with Ajahn Gunho in the demilitarized zone over between the Koreas. And I always remember his teaching. You get him to try and teach meditation, and he wouldn't teach much at all. All he'd ever teach was, breathe in, sabai. And sabai is the Thai word for just free and easy and nice and wonderful. And then breathe out. Sabha. Whoa. Breathe in, Sabha. Breathe out, Sabha. And he was a great meditation teacher. Really simple. So that's going to be the next little exercise. Close your eyes. You get the idea what sort of, you don't even know Thai or whatever. So, and now, okay, here we start. Get yourself nice and relaxed. And breathe in. Sabha. And breathe out, Sabha. Breathe in. Oh, it's nice. Breathe out. Oh, this is great. Breathe in. Oh, yeah, give me more of that. Breathe out. Oh, lovely. Now you don't need to make those noises. But you get the idea. You actually add the happiness onto the breathing. And you can do that. You just really get into the breath. Just really breathe it. Just whoa. Really nice. All you're doing there is actually you're not afraid of the happiness. You're looking for the happiness. You're developing the happiness in meditation. And it's there. Why not? And after a while you get a connoisseur of the delight of peace. It's gorgeous peace. Sometimes people in meditation said, ah, you're smiling, stop it. You're happy, you get attached. You're enjoying yourself, this is not religion. Religion, you're supposed to suffer. Come on, suffer. And sometimes people had that idea that, you know, if you're not miserable, you're not practicing. And there's something in that. I was born with this idea. That can't be right. So anyway, you go to see great teachers like an Ajahn Chah, just so happy. And he was meditating, you never saw him grimace. I'm gonna really, another 5 minutes. I'm gonna do this. So, you know the word for breath meditation? What's it called? Anapanasati. Ana means like along with. Pana is the breath. And sati, mindfulness. A long breath, mindfulness. And the Buddha never ever taught anywhere, either in the suttas or in the commentary, Abhidhamma, nowhere it mentions anapanasati. We don't do mindfulness along with pain. It's supposed to be the middle way. So what we actually do is we learn just how to appreciate the breath. And when it gets delightful, we actually, what you're doing is changing the object of your meditation to joy. It's the breath, but it becomes the delightful breath. And sometimes if you don't do that with your breath, you do that with your walking meditation. You know, you start, haven't said too much about walking meditation yet, but it's, you know, it's exactly the same. It's summer. When you start walking, you know, you just, usually I advise people to put your head down, but just to gaze maybe 2 meters like a body length in front of you. Just for the sense of safety, so you're not going to step on something, you're not going to bang your head in the wall. You've got your eyes open, just 2 meters ahead, not to the left, not to the right, just the floor, 2 meters ahead. And you put your hands somewhere where, you know, you can forget about them. And then you walk, naturally. And after a little while, your attention goes to how you're walking. Left foot, right foot, but then how the left foot moves. And I said the other day, it just becomes so mindful, it becomes quite natural, just how the foot moves. How it lifts up and goes forward and just goes down, and how it transfers the weight, you know, onto that foot so the other foot is free to move. And you have this wonderful awareness of just the amazing, amazing just the details of just one foot movement, which you've got used to. It's a habit now, so you don't need to really think about it, you just move. But it's amazing how many muscles have to move for just one step to occur. It's one of the reasons why in artificial intelligence, robots, is one of the hardest things to do to get the robot to actually walk like a human. It's, you know, we take it for granted, but it's a very, very complex series of operations, just one step. But anyway, you're just watching that, you're watching it move, and it becomes happy, it becomes delightful. And when I first ordained, it was in a city temple, very noisy, in Wat Saket, over in Thailand. And in the mornings, you know, you did some chanting and about 5 minutes of meditation. That was all they did there. But I stayed in the hall to do walking meditation. And the hall was, oh, maybe not even as long as this hall here. And they had, I don't know why they did this, but they had a grandfather clock, which chimed like Big Ben in London, the quarter hours. But at least that I knew roughly about the time I was taking. And it was natural. I wasn't forcing it. It took me half an hour to walk from one side to the next, turn around and come back again. So 1 hour just from here to there and there and back again. That was my walking meditation, an hour. And it wasn't forced. It was just because of watching all the movements in the feet. You couldn't rush. And on this one occasion, just to show just how peaceful and how happy you become, that there I was, and maybe about 45, 50 minutes into the meditation, nearing the end, just really just, you know, my head was down, I could feel all these incredible movements of the feet. It was amazing and so delightful. And then I heard this sound, like from 1,000 miles away. Brahma Wang So. Brahma Wang So. You know, like you go into meditation, it's like the sound gets so distant. And then I realized it was a monk shouting in my ear about this far away. Because I had to go to like a dana, like a food offering. And I'd forgotten all about it. And he was sent to come and fetch me. And I was, you know, such a junior monk and very respectful, but I just couldn't move. You know, because Brahma was, oh, and I realized I had to sort of, you know, start moving again and start my brain going. But it was so difficult, and I remember, because he was just to my right, and I was looking down, and I had to move my head. It's amazing, just the muscles which have to be used just to turn your head. It's a fantastic process. Just moving a little bit, 1,000 different muscles have to move and coordinate. And I was moving, but as fast as I possibly could. And eventually, you know, I faced him. What? And I wasn't being disrespectful. You really just get into this zone of peace and happiness. And I can't resist this story. This was a story about the gentleman who did one of these meditation retreats. You know, he really got in the zone. Everything was so peaceful and so slow. Because even just walking, so much is going on. You know, you can't rush. You can't move fast. Too many things happening. So anyway, he reported for work. He was working in Perth Zoo. And so the head zookeeper saw him. Oh, here he comes. He's been on a retreat again. Good morning, boss. He's being respectful, but know, just to speak, with so many muscles have to be moved, just to speak. Have you ever noticed the speaking? It's just incredible. Just what we take for granted and just let it come out is, when you're really mindful, wow. And so the boss thought, okay, he's back again. What can I do for him this morning? Because you can't sack people. We've got fair work practices, non-discrimination. So, you know, you can't just send him home. So, oh, crikey, what could I... And so the head zookeeper was really smart. He said, I've got the very job for you this morning. You can look after the tortoise enclosure. Okay, I will go to tortoise. And so off he went, walking really slowly to look after the tortoises. And then at lunchtime, the head keeper decided to check up on this fellow. So he went to the tortoise. No, the tortoise enclosure, the door was open, and there's no tortoises inside. He said, what happened? Where are the tortoises? And so this meditator said, well, I... opened the door and whoosh, whoosh. For him, the tortoises were so fast. It was like whoosh to him. That's a crazy old joke. But anyway, when you do walking meditation, sometimes you get into that zone. It's so peaceful and it's so lovely, so joyful. You're there and just happy as anything, just walking. And people think you're crazy, but this is what happens when you slow down and get peaceful. You get so much joy and happiness coming up. Same with the breath. Beautiful. Oh, yeah. It's called a citta sankhara. It's how the mind looks at it. And the mind is actually seeing such beauty. One of the reasons is because things are going slow. When things go slow naturally like that, it's like you're not expending energy. Your brain doesn't have to work so hard computing everything. Again, after I'd been in the forest for 7 years, I went over to England. I remember I was sitting in this house of this guy over in Scotland, and looking through two open doors, I saw a TV which was on. And I could not believe how fast the images would change. Really bright, very fast, and just one frame of the TV would just change almost immediately to something else. And when you've been in the forest, hadn't seen the TV for 7 years, that was just so painful for the senses, like an assault on the senses. I thought, wow, how can people stand this? And if ever you look at just, you know, the time on a TV, how long the frame before something moves, it's so fast and so loud. And so much more intense colors than usually in the real world. So that was just, wow, this is so disturbing. And then I realized this, you know, to for your brain to actually to make sense of all of that, you have to work so hard. Maybe you're used to it, but it is hard work for the brain to watch a movie. You get tired, exhausted. So you're staying here just watching breath going in. People say that's boring. It's actually quite restful. And because you don't waste so much energy trying to figure out what it all means, you get energized. This is where you get power mindfulness from. You start to wake up. You've got energy. What you see and what you taste, the baked bean as people reminded me of. Oh, never tasted a baked bean like that ever before. I don't know what you have for breakfast this morning, whether it's noodles or whether it's porridge. What do you have this morning? Porridge. Twice and twice. But when you've had a good meditation, you take that first spoon of porridge. Wow. Wow. Just let it linger in your mouth. Don't swallow it yet. Let the taste sort of ooze into every one of your sensory taste buds in your mouth. And let the aroma just swell into your nose, and you can smell it and you can taste it, and the texture of the porridge. And just not too hot, not too cold, and you can feel it. Wow. Try that next time. Really get into it. And you'll find it's not that hard to do. And you thought, am I going crazy? You're not, but actually you're beginning to learn how to taste things. You're not rushing. You're not fast. You're slowing down. And brings me up to the anecdote of the road up to this retreat centre, Kingsbury Drive. So the main road at the bottom of the hill is called the Southwest Highway. And anyway, I was about for 7 years. I'd always been going up and down that road in a car, in a vehicle, and then it's one day, beautiful morning. So, okay, I'm going to have some exercise. It's very hard to get exercise as a monk, honestly, because what happens is some say, no, I'll give you a lift. So I want to walk. No, my car needs merit. Well, you know, in those days it wasn't so serious. So I said, no, I insist. I'm going to walk. So they went up to the top, and it was a beautiful morning. I was in no rush. It's not trying to, you know, beat the record of rushing up the hill, racing up. It was a nice leisurely stroll in the morning sunshine. As I was walking up the hill, just looking around, a weird thing happened. I just could not recognize my surroundings. Been up and down that hill for 7 years, maybe two or three times a week. That's right. This is weird. This is strange. I don't recognize that. It was like walking up that hillside for the first time ever. And of course, that was so strange that I stopped. I just stopped by the side of the road and stared into the valley. And then it changed again. It got deeper, richer, more detailed, and more beautiful. Never realized that hillside was so gorgeous. What's happening? And use logic, science, cause and effect. Now I know. When you look at that hillside through the window of a car going at maybe 60 kilometers an hour, bang, 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 the light, the scenes change so fast. And I think it's normal. You're not speeding, but it's still, you look there, you see one scene, the light hits the back of the eye, the retina, chemical reaction turned into electrical pulses along the optic nerve. Nothing fully forms. But when you walk, you go slower. The process of sight has more chance, more time to make a fuller image on the back of your eye. You literally see more, with more detail. And the lovely thing is, the unexpected bonus is the colours have more chance to actually to form. They're richer, instead of like washed out. And then when you stand perfectly still, that's the best. Because the image on the back of the eye fully forms, has all the time it needs for the reds and the yellows, the magentas, everything to make really full. And you can see all the detail. And that became so amazing, delightful. You thought, why have I never seen this before? Because I'd never taken the time to be still. To stop. And let even just the simple sense of sight, fully form. And that became a simile for me of what is called power mindfulness. You're going slow when you are walking. And what you see is not just more detail, but the detail is richer. It is, you can feel things more deeply, more fully. It becomes delightful. And so with your eating, your porridge, you let it linger. And you taste more. And it's actually gorgeous food. And you look at the bamboo floor in front of you. Millions of different shades of brown. And the way they interact together. You just let it linger. And it, like, it opens out to you. And you see amazing stuff. That's always the sign of power mindfulness. In the ordinary, you see incredible beauty. And this is where you go to William Blake, one of my favorite poets, 17th century. He's also an artist as well. I had some of his reproductions, little posters, because I love that stuff he wrote and did. To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. Supposed to be a mystic, but he just has strong mindfulness, which is why poets can actually see deeply into things. Maybe it was because he didn't have to rush around so much as people these days do. You can actually linger and pause and see deeply into things. So sometimes if, you know, you get some really nice mindfulness, how you're still. The Chitta Sankara, you see a blade of grass. Have a look at it, just a simple blade of grass outside. And it opens up. Amazing just what's there. It's not just a blade of grass, it's so many different shades of green. And sometimes in the young grass, it's really powerful, young, vibrant green. And if you're lucky, it may be a little waving in the wind a little bit. And you can write a whole poem about a blade of grass in your head. You see its beauty. It's something so simple. And you wonder, why do people need sort of TVs and movies and stuff, which is just so gross, according to the simple, deep beauties in something natural when your mind is peaceful and still. So that means also when you close your eyes and you watch your breath, what you thought was something just so ordinary becomes something so delightful. Breathing in, oh. Breathing out. So delightful. Just the way the mindfulness has gone strong and the way it sees things is just gorgeous. And that means you can stay watching the breath for long periods of time. It's not effort. You don't try and beat your personal best, as I say. You're just enjoying it. It's really good fun. Peaceful. Great for the health. Great for the intellect as well, to give your brain a deep, deep rest. And you're enjoying it. Sitting here, breathing in. And you know that happens because if you really get into the delightful breath, you're sitting here at 11 o'clock. It's lunchtime. And you have a choice. Go for lunch or stay with your breath. And you know it's your last chance to eat. It's amazing how many people, faced with that choice, stay with the breath. That's how delightful it is. It's not trying to prove anything to people. It's not, well, my friend, you know, she missed lunch yesterday, so I'm as good as she is, so I'm going to show her. It's not ego or self, it's just nature. So that's what we mean by the delightful breath, and that's when the breath really starts, or the meditation really starts to take off. When it's delightful, you're enjoying it. And that is now why people like me are monks. I like my pleasure.
He said, hang on, I said, Bob, what do you mean you like your pleasure? You know, you haven't got sort of girlfriends. You haven't got TVs. You don't take drugs or alcohol. Well, how come you're so happy? Breathing in. Whoa. Breathing out. Wow. A baked bean. Whoa. This must have been 6-star Michelin chef who put that bean into that can. So people think it's crazy, but you know there's some truth in that, and sometimes you can touch such beauty and delight in the meditation. So you can't make it happen. Every time you try, you take the energy away. You just have to let it happen. Just be there, just watching, doing nothing, re-energizing your brain and your mind, giving it a boost of power. And every time you try and do something, expect something, make something happen, want something, you just waste the energy. You waste the power. You just stay there, hold on, don't do anything. Notice the more you relax, the more that the muscles will close. And then you have this beautiful time. Meditation is meant to be joyful. It's supposed to be, that's what it's supposed to do. So when you get into this, it's not, I'm a Buddhist, I suppose I should get up and meditate now. Yeah, I better do so, otherwise I'm guilty. It's just like going to the dentist or going to the gym. Push, 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 I'm supposed to do this. But this is actually just, you love it. You meditate, oh, this is great. You really get into it. And of course, it's a pleasure. It's an addiction. Which the Buddha said, just closing off this talk, the Buddha said, anyone who's addicted to the pleasures of meditation can only expect 4 benefits. 4 things, that's all they can expect. This is in the Pasadika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. Anyone who's interested, I can show it to you afterwards. It's also, I quoted it in the Word of the Buddha class, Word of the Buddha documents. Anyone who's addicted to the pleasures of meditation can only expect stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's the only 4 outcomes. It's not bad, is it? That's what we're supposed to be getting. So you get the pleasure of the meditation and get all your enlightenment as well. That, I think, is a very good marketing. So have a blissful meditation. Sad. 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 Okay.